when justice will roll down like waters and righteousness as a mighty stream. Lord, in the memory of all the saints who from their labors rest, and in the joy of a new beginning, we ask you to help us work for that day when black will not be asked to get back, when brown can stick around, when yellow will be mellow, when the red man can get ahead, man, and when white will embrace what is right. Let all those who do justice and love mercy say amen.
Amen.
Say amen,
amen.
And amen.
Amen.
This is where we are right now. It's a racial stalemate we've been stuck in for years. And contrary to the claims of some of my critics, black and white, I have never been so naive as to believe that we can get beyond our racial divisions in a single election cycle or with a single candidate, particularly a candidacy as imperfect as my own. But I have asserted a firm conviction, a conviction rooted in my faith in God and my faith in the American people, that working together, we can move beyond some of our old racial wounds, and that, in fact, we have no choice. We have no choice if we are to continue on the path of a more perfect union.
Good evening. My name is Paul Holden Graber, and I'm the director of Live from the New York Public Library. My goal, as you know, quite simply, is to make the lions roar. Many of you know that I say this too often, but one more time, my goal is to make the lions roar and to make this institution levitate. To help achieve this goal tonight, an exchange about Obama and race, featuring Ta-Nehisi Coates and David Remnick. And coming up live from the New York Public Library this spring to further advance our mission, come here this Friday, George Prochnick, discuss his pursuit of silence in our loud world. What are the benefits of decluttering our sonic world? Later this month, an evening about Candide to celebrate our exhibition here at the New York Public Library, Candide at 250. It's 250 years old, Scandal and Success, co-curated by the president of the New York Public Library, Paul Leclerc, who is present tonight and who I would like to recognize. Paul. Later in the month, an evening with Peter Carey, who will be joined by Claire Messoud and Edmund Dwight. And at the end of April, I will have the pleasure of interviewing Patti Smith. We end our season with a night about soccer and the World Cup, some sports from time to time, but also a conversation with Lena Herzog and Lawrence Weskler. I will also be speaking with John Waters and Christopher Hitchens, but don't worry, it won't happen on the same night. Christopher Hitchens, you may be intrigued to know, has just completed a memoir entitled Hitch 22. I would also like to alert you to a very interesting program the Cullman Center for Writers and Scholars is presenting tomorrow night right here in the Barthes Forum on the Shakespeare authorship controversy with Columbia University professor James Shapiro and the New York Times columnist Randy Cohen. Announcements for all these programs are on your chairs in this room and online. I suggest you join our mailing list. Libraries matter so much in the life of our nation. To the point of the conversation tonight, you may already know that President Obama found his first job as a community organizer in Chicago because a librarian at the Mid-Manhattan Library of the New York Public Library helped him. Now, you will agree, I think, that the destiny of our nation might have been changed, were it not for that librarian. Now, what I don't think you know is that Keith Richards, yes, Keith Richards right after Barack Obama. One of the founding members of the Rolling Stones is writing his memoir, due out in October. In it, he confesses his secret longing. I hope you're ready for this. He's always wanted to be a librarian. When you are growing up, Keith Richards writes, there are two institutional places that affect you most powerfully: the church, which belongs to God, and the public library that belongs to you. The public library is a great equalizer. Now, it may not surprise you that I plan to invite Keith Richards to be on this stage live come October to discuss the role of libraries in our democracy. I think I'll discuss something else with him too, but at least that. I urge you to become a supporter of the New York Public Library, be it as a young lion, if you happen to be young enough, or as a conservator, or consider joining the President's Council. But nobody here should put off becoming a friend of the New York Public Library. For just $40 a year, you will be a friend of the New York Public Library. That's, if you ask me, a pretty cheap date. With it, you will get all kinds of great discounts, including the programs of the New York Public Library Live will be discounted for you. This evening, tonight, is co-sponsored by Sutherland, Asbill, and Brennan, a proud supporter of the New York Public Library and a member of its Lawyers for the Library Committee. Founded in 1924, Sutherland provides legal services throughout the United States and worldwide. Tonight, I would like to particularly recognize Bill Bradley, who is on the Lawyers for the Library Committee and who spearheaded the sponsorship. Thank you very much, Bill Bradley. During tonight's conversation, we will ask you to write out any questions you might have. I will pick a few of the best ones, the ones that are most legible, as well as the ones that are succinct. So you know what you need to do to be chosen. David Remnick will sign the bridge, The Life and Rise of Barack Obama, at the conclusion of the evening. As always, we thank our independent bookseller, 192 Books, for their help. It is a pleasure to welcome back to a Live from the New York Public Library event, Ta-Nehisi Coates, who was here nearly exactly 1 year ago on April 9th, 2009, in a program we co-sponsored with Book Forum on Black Nationalism in the Obama Era. Ta-Nehisi Coates is the son of a former Black Panther and wrote a memoir entitled The Beautiful Struggle, A Father, Two Sons, and an Unlikely Road to Manhood. I think it's only fitting that Ta-Nehisi's son, aged 9, should be here tonight. Coates is a senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly. It is a great pleasure also to welcome back David Remnick, who has been on this stage numerous times. David sits on the board of trustees of the New York Public Library, and as all of you know, I imagine, since 1998, is the editor of The New Yorker. He's a recipient of a Pulitzer Prize for Lenin's Tomb. He has written numerous books, among them King of the World, on the evolution of Cassius Clay into Muhammad Ali in the midst of the civil rights movement. His book, The Bridge, The Life and Rise of Barack Obama, came out today. I am thrilled to be welcoming him to this stage for what I know and for what I hope will be a spirited exchange on Obama and race. Ta-Nehisi Coates and David Remnick.
Wow, a lot of people. As a kind of prerequisite for having the privilege of interviewing David, I've been given many lectures not to go soft on him.
Great.
I've had the luxury of working for David a couple times, and so there was great concern that I might be intimidated. But I think it was maybe in the Times today, somebody referred to David as a player coach. He's an editor who actually stoops down to our level sometimes and is willing to write and write quite well. But the thing about being a player coach is when you're in practice, the other players get to foul you. It's a beautiful thing. So you get to exact some measure of revenge for your coach's lectures upon you. And so I say that to assure you guys that I'm going to enjoy this very much tonight. It's quite an honor. So.
Will I? Okay, elbows out.
I wanted to start with a particular question for you in terms of identity. The book is obviously very much about Barack Obama's identity. In your writing, you're not a big first-person sort of I journalist, but I wonder how much your own identity influenced your attraction to the story, shaped how you approached the story, if at all.
You mean ethnic identity?
Yes, very much so.
I got mine at the kitchen table. I got mine in the community that I grew up in. I got mine in the New York area. It came easily to me to some degree. I mean, I think that there's lots of the aspect of being an American Jew that is not complete in me. Belief is one. That's not something that's a big part of my life. And my knowledge of the great tradition of learning is limited, and I hope I'll correct that as I get older. But I didn't have to figure out how I was as a Jewish American at a kitchen table with Episcopalian grandparents and a missing Jewish father in a little rock in the middle of the Pacific Ocean where there were no Jews except on military bases. Mm-hmm. That's an idea, isn't it? That's Barack Obama's, the very crude frame of Barack Obama's story of what was missing. Look how much he had to figure out. I mean, he's born who he is. He can look in the mirror. But it must have been extraordinarily confusing to have this father who was a ghost, a myth, a collection of stories that he barely knew. And by the way, were highly unreliable. He spent 10 days with his father during his conscious life. 10 days. He grew up in Honolulu and went to a highly privileged school where there were a couple of other black students. And in a place that prided itself on multiculturalism before it was even a word, with no black people around, except for the occasional soldier on the basketball court or at a party. So where does he get it from? He watches TV, he reads books. I mean, it's a really mystifying, difficult thing.
And you know, yeah, even as you say that, and I've heard that before, there's a long portion in your book where you place Barack Obama's autobiography, his memoir, mm-hmm. in the tradition of African-American memoir. Mm-hmm. And for African-Americans, there's always this sort of sense of distinguishing or defining yourself by your own terms as opposed to what the world defines mm-hmm. you as. So you talk some about Malcolm X being in prison and having to rediscover himself right. and redefine blackness in a way that's very different than how he defined it when he was out on the street.
The literature, like the people, is immensely diverse. There's not one book repeated endlessly, beginning with slave narratives. And he very self-consciously writes this memoir with an awareness of these books that helped him become himself, an awareness of their structure. And that book, Dreams for My Father, has a structure that's very similar to many other African-American memoirs, and also memoirs by other writers who are trying to find their identity. Not just African-Americans, but he's particularly interested in that himself. And what does that mean? Well, he's a guy who has an absent father, Malcolm X, Richard Wright. He's in search of his own name. He's in search of an ethnic identity. He's in search of a community. He's in search of a purpose in his life. I mean, all these things he has to go out and get. He makes a journey. And you can name almost every African-American memoir of great importance, and they all have, in some way or another, these elements of physical journey, psychic journey, finding a community, finding a purpose. So he's writing in that tradition. It's a highly structured book, too. That book is a young man's book by a guy who's read a lot of books. It's in three sections. Each one ends with him, and this is not a guy we know for his high emotional content or exhibitionism, ending in tears. Each section ends with him in tears, whether it's he finds Jeremiah Wright's church and a faith and a sense of place in Chicago, or whether he's at his father's grave in the Kenyan village of Kagera, or at the end of the book. So it's a very structured book. It's a very good book. It's also a book that's probably, at this point, overrated is a word we use on, you know, sports talk radio, but I mean that it's valued in an outsized way because of the political content and his importance as a historical figure.
And did you, one of the things that I try to do in understanding race, this goes for anybody in the country, is look for analogs in the American experience. And obviously that presents specific difficulty. Slavery obviously presents a very specific difficulty. The African-American experience is a very unique thing. But we're always looking for analogies to help us understand. I wonder if you found analogs for his journey in other ethnic Americans. This is part of why I started out with the question about your own identity.
Well, we just had Seder, right? And which is all about slavery, exile, liberation from bondage. It's thousands of years ago. It's a lot longer ago. But that story has a biblical resonance, so much so that you see it in the black church all the time. What's the first major address that Barack Obama gives to the African-American community after he's announced for the presidency? He goes and gives a speech in Selma, Alabama, this resonant place of the civil rights struggle, and he talks about the Moses generation, a well-known black guy, and the Joshua generation. Moses' generation, the generation of civil rights, the generation of King, of Joseph Lowery, who we just heard,
right,
of John Lewis, and about himself and the Joshua generation. I mean, he is giving himself an enormous task, and with great gall, he's placing himself at the head of a generation, and I'm going to take you where? To the promised land. I mean, that's an amazingly ballsy thing to say. And he's saying it directly in Brown's Chapel, where Martin Luther King had spoken in the pulpit so many times. So resonances, yes. Analogies, yes. But one thing doesn't always equal another. I wouldn't begin to compare the Jewish American experience to the African American experience. First of all, you were here a lot longer and in very, very different circumstances. And we don't have to play the comparative suffering game, but it's one thing doesn't equal the other exactly. But there are metaphors, there are biblical resonances, even in Obama's own language.
I want to come back to the whole Joshua generation thing in a second, but I want to stick with him as a young man in Hawaii. The influence of his mother in terms of defining himself as an African American. We just had this story, and I kind of, not to insert my own blog into this, but kind of joked about it on the blog that this notion that he checked black on the census was a story, because he's often, you know, said as much. Did he choose? Did he actually have a choice? Do you have any insight to why it might be news, why it's surprising?
Well, I think race is something that is often both chosen and acquired. It's something that is given to you genetically, historically, but it's also something that you have some say in. Obama had some say in this, and he chose certain ways of educating himself, of being, of identifying. Where does he plant himself when he has the first chance he gets? He gets off of Hawaii as soon as he possibly can. He goes to Los Angeles. That's too remote from the city.
And do you think race is part of that?
Absolutely. Because he says that I left Occidental College, which is near Pasadena, to get to Columbia University because it's closer to an urban center and closer to an African-American population, near Harlem.
Right.
And where does he go after that? The south side of Chicago. And that's where he comes alive. That's where he finds a sense of purpose and identification and all those things we know. That's where he really finds his sense of idealism and his ethnic... I don't think he ever had an option to be Chinese-American or even white. But he chose a very definite way of being.
But he certainly could have... Obviously, these two people are in very different fields, but he certainly could have defined himself as multiracial, Koblen Asian, to take to still
people,
Tiger Woods.
And people do. It should also be made, to state the obvious, that some very, very high percentage of African Americans somewhere along the line have Caucasian genetic material in their bloodstreams, in their genetic material. But that's hardly everything.
Right.
Hardly everything.
And do you think...
With him, though, it was a very particular kind of problem or circumstance because of the missing father, the present mother, or mostly present mother, and these grandparents and where he grew up. He didn't grow up with those same set of circumstances, you know, in Kenwood or Englewood or anywhere else in the South Side.
And how do you think the decision, to an extent that it was a decision, to the extent that he, and in his book he talks about this, meeting people, he kind of jokes about it. He meets all these people who say, "I'm not black, I'm multiracial," and he jokes that he never sees them hanging around any black people, even though they claim to be open to everything.
Yeah. He encounters this at Occidental a lot.
Right. How does that play into his political career? I wonder, had he, again, to the extent that there was a choice to identify, "I'm multiracial, I'm not necessarily black."
It's a huge theme in his political career. Every step of the way, race plays a gigantic role every time he runs for office. When he ran for state senator, he committed an act of impiety against the longstanding regulars there by refusing to step back from Alice Palmer, who had a much deeper relationship to the community than he did. When he ran for Congress in 2000, he ran against the former Black Panther and somebody extremely popular on the South Side, an act of impiety, and he got his ass handed to him. He lost 2-1, and it was an ugly, ugly race in which Bobby Rush and another opponent really were putting it out on the street that this guy is inauthentic, not black enough was the phrase, that he's an outsider. He's not really one of us. He doesn't have our experience, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which is a complete denial of the black experience in America, which is immensely diverse, whether it's people who are from the Caribbean or from Africa or from... This subject is that dogs him all the way. It doesn't begin with the presidential race. It even happens in the Senate race in 2004.
And since you mentioned Bobby Rush, there's a great scene in your book, and we've talked about this, where... Bobby Rush harps on how Obama walks, his bop, as we tend to call it. And he jokes that Obama did not walk like that before he came to Chicago and that he acquired this kind of way of walking.
I'm going to do you a favor. I am not going to get up and imitate Bobby Rush.
No, we're not going to. But it's a great scene because Bobby Rush stands up and does the walk. And
yeah, Bobby Rush is not a young man anymore. His health is not the best. He's very tall and very skinny, and he is the cock of the walk. Why? He's the cock of the walk because he's the one guy that beat Obama, and he beat him soundly. So here he is in his congressional office. It's very nice that Barack has won finally, and he's he's mocking him, and then he gets up and he just sashays across the office, and he said, back then he didn't walk like that when he ran against me. He's accusing him even to this day of inauthenticity, as if we all don't learn.
Right.
As if we're sort of born with walks and all kinds of things.
Well, and the funny thing, that was very interesting to me is my spouse, who lives in Chicago, who's from Chicago, she always talks about when she moved to the West Side, she had to learn the double Dutch at age 12. I used to practice my bob in the mirror. I'm not ashamed to admit that. So it was acquired with me also. But in reading that, it struck me that some of this is potentially not just African Americans, but Chicago, that his reception may have been different in Harlem, where you have Africans, where you have Caribbeans,
absolutely,
as well as black Americans,
absolutely,
up from the South.
I think, without overgeneralizing about populations, that in the South Side of Chicago, especially back then when he's first encountering it, it's more purely the classic Great Migration, African Americans from Mississippi and the rest of those places that begins... Well, around World War I and lasts until 1970, and all that coming first to the South Side and then to the West Side, which is significantly poorer and less established and has less diversity of economies. Whereas Harlem, even back then, you had immigrations from really all over the place. It's quite a different scene, and I think it's quite possible that the greatest stroke of luck that Barack Obama ever had, and nobody gets anywhere or very far without luck playing some role, is to end up in Chicago at that crucial moment as a young man. And it just meant everything to him.
And you think, because let's say he stays in New York, does he get subsumed by Charlie Rangel and that whole machine? That has a new meaning now. I wasn't aware. Just like that.
Yeah.
Right.
That. Right. That thing you were saying.
Right, yeah. Right, right.
But Harlem has a political, clubhouse.
Right.
It's in its senescence now. It's in its decline. But there's been an establishment there that was very well ordered and tough to crack for decades. Chicago's a little bit more fluid, and also it extends to the West Side too. It's just a different scene.
There's also a great scene, and I can't remember whether he's campaigning for. I've complimented him too much already. I'm clearly failing here. Nevertheless, there is a great scene.
This reminds me of the Obama thing on the basketball court where he's being nice to the guy, he's being nice to the guy, and the next thing you know, Obama is sinking threes and killing the guy. So I know, life is long.
There's a scene where, forgive my language, where one of the guys basically says to him, "Motherfucker, you got to learn how to talk."
Exactly.
When he gets in his face and says that. Can you talk some about his education?
Well, I would never use language like that in the New York Public Library.
Right. George Carlin was here, so I felt free to go ahead and quote.
But just like you said.
Right.
Obama was smart enough when he was, even when he was getting his ass handed to him in the congressional race in 2000, to hire some people that knew their way around, as they call them in Chicago, taverns and clubhouses, and not just, he didn't just bring his Harvard friends. And they would yell at him. They said, you're going to these black churches and you're talking like you're teaching law at the University of Chicago. But he hadn't learned it yet.
Right.
This is not something you get in Hawaii.
Right. Right.
This is not something you get the first five times you do it.
Right.
Barack Obama didn't give it took practice. It's like being a musician. You don't get to be Sonny Rollins by picking up the saxophone five or six times and say, I'm there, let's do it. You do it over and over and over again, and you woodshed. And that's what's amazing about Barack Obama, is how quickly he got to the level he did as a politician. Let's remember one thing. He was a state senator. This is not an exalt. And everybody raise your hand if you can name your state senator. Okay, that's pathetic. And that's at the library. Okay? That's pathetic, and you can be sure the percentages are not much higher anywhere else. That's who he was. And suddenly he runs for Congress, and he loses, and his wife says, "Okay, honey, that's enough. You're the president of the Harvard Law Review, and you're making with this. We still have college loans, and we may have college loans until we're on Social Security. It's time to do good and do well." And he goes into the Woods Foundation, and he interviews to be the head of the Woods Foundation, which is this big charitable foundation that gives away lots of money, and you get a great big salary and maybe a membership at a country club or something, and you'd be doing good and doing well. And his hands are shaking during the job interview. And they come out of the interview, and the head of the Woods Foundation says, "Look, you can have the job if you want it, but Rock, you don't want this.
Right.
You've got the political bug." And his friends at the University of Chicago just thought he was ridiculous. Why is he doing this? Why is he continuing in politics? He had the bug. He wanted to be that. He is a Paul, right? I mean, we think of him in exalted terms and should in many ways, and we think of him in many different terms, but he is also a politician who believes.
Can you define that in a little bit more tangible terms? What specifically?
Somebody who is not speaking in the prophetic voice. He's not Martin Luther King. He's not Gandhi. He's a guy who believes in the art of the possible. I have to get elected to do what I want to do, and once I'm elected, I can get done what is possible. We are not living in a world of single-payer health insurance. We are living, thank God, in a world of health insurance that's a lot better than it was a few weeks ago, although we haven't felt it yet. A lot better. And I look, in my heart, but I don't think with my heart. In my heart, do I think Barack Obama is against gay marriage? I mean, I'm as for it as one could be for anything. And he's against it, and he talks about civil unions and all the rest. But he's a politician. He thinks that if he races too far ahead of the general populace, he will leave them behind and lose. That's the way a politician thinks. And it's not unreasonable to think so. So that is a big part of his. He's not speaking in the prophetic voice. He is echoing the prophetic voice when he gives a speech. He is echoing Martin Luther King or even Malcolm X when he was in South Carolina, which was a great moment. An interesting moment.
Right, very much.
But he's got to win. He's not the president of Black America. He's the president of the United States, and he won the state of North Carolina. And in other states where it was miraculous for a Democrat to win, much less Barack Hussein Obama. So that is a remarkable political feat, not a prophetic achievement.
And yet, you know, there still are people out there who are speaking in the prophetic voice as they define themselves.
Well, he was asked once, I think it was in an interview or debate, he said, he was asked, I think Hillary was in the race, and who would Martin Luther King have voted for? Well, this is the kind of question that people in my loosely defined profession like to just kind of roll under the door, like in a Bruce Willis movie, and see what happens. Obama answered it brilliantly. He said, Martin Luther King would not be for any of us. He would be pushing us, pushing us and criticizing us to go farther and farther in the direction of justice.
It strikes me, though, that people who are speaking in the prophetic voice, the critics, his African-American critics, with very real and respectable ideals, have a different problem than Martin Luther King had. I'm pretty sure Lyndon Johnson didn't get 94%
Absolutely.
Of the African-American. I mean,
this is
a guy who's immensely popular.
That's
and so
right.
they don't have the masses on their side in the same way.
That's
and it
right.
strikes me as a very different challenge.
Yeah, but, you know, Lyndon Johnson had something else. Lyndon Johnson's mentor in the Senate is Richard Russell, who's a very effective Senate leader who just also happens to be a segregationist racist.
Right.
And Lyndon Johnson comes along and for both political reasons and moral reasons decides to be for a Civil Rights Act and for a Voting Rights Act, which is a complete betrayal of his mentor.
Right.
So he has other political imperatives
right.
and jiu-jitsu acts to achieve.
And I wonder, for people who... We talked about this some upstairs, too, so forgive me for bringing this back in.
They don't know that.
Yeah, they don't know that. I'm just going to recycle here. How can critics get around that? I mean, if you can't put numbers on the street, if you can't have a march on watch, people are just not going to get fired up. Tavis Smiley had his new version of his State of the Black Union a couple weeks back.
Yeah.
And Michael Eric Dyson asserted that he was not Joshua Moses, he was Pharaoh. That's mm-hmm. what he called Obama. And that's defensible.
Why did he call him Pharaoh? He called him Pharaoh because he's keeping his own people down?
No, because he's in power now. He's the power.
Well,
he's
the power
now. He's the structure, yes.
He is.
So in a sense, I mean, I say that that's definitely defensible. But unlike in the 60s and unlike before the 60s, he can't motivate mass groups of people, mass groups of African Americans out to protest Barack Obama. It strikes me as a very different
challenge. No, he's motivated his opposition.
Right.
It's the Tea Party movement that's on the streets. And the Tea Party movement, which even has a little Saul Alinsky in them, but they're motivated. I think a lot of them are motivated by legitimate concerns. When any time you have 10% unemployment and the economic unsureness that we have, historically there's going to be real upset. You put a black president into that picture, and you shouldn't be shocked. And then you add the incredible propaganda machine that is seen in parts of the internet and on Fox and all the rest. And, you know, look out. Look out. Now, again, I want to emphasize there are people in the Tea Party movement that are legit conservatives and, you know, decent people, and I may disagree with them on just about every issue imaginable. But there are also aspects of this movement that are but ugly, that are dangerous, and it's egged on by people on television at times, and the obvious people. And you know, it can lead to a horrendous outcome.
How different would it have been with Hillary Clinton?
It's hard to say, but I don't think it would have been any picnic for the first woman as a president mm-hmm. either.
Mm-hmm. I want to just go back to Chicago for a moment. Can you talk some more about why at that particular moment he didn't quit. I know you said he had it within him, but he also had other concerns. His wife really wanted him to quit.
Mm-hmm.
If you could talk about their relationship, how he brought her along.
Yeah, I think, you know, she's a traditional woman. She grew up in this family. Her father is working for the city, and her mother works for, I think it was the Spiegel Catalog for a while as a receptionist, and then is at home. And what happens? And they live in this very modest house on the south side. And the older son goes to Princeton, and that's a big deal. It's a big deal for any family, I can tell you that. And it's a big, big deal for the Robinsons. And then she gets in. And to some extent, Princeton's a mixed bag. They used to say about Princeton when I was there a long time ago that it was the northernmost point of the Confederacy. It wasn't New Jersey as I knew it growing up. But, you know, it is a pretty gilded place and not the south side of Chicago. And then she goes to Harvard Law School, and she's more at ease, and she does. In fact, she's way more idealistic than Obama in law school. Mm-hmm. She's working for the poor. You know, she's defending indigent clients. Obama, not so much. He's doing the straighter arrow thing. He's at the Harvard Law Review. His mentors are not Charles Ogletree so much as they are Larry Tribe and Martha Minow, who are, you know, white, liberal, constitutional scholars, especially in Tribe's case. It's a slightly different path. Harvard is not their intersection because they're at different times. She wants him. She said, you know, you're such a star. Great, do good. Do some pro bono cases. When I was growing up and I announced to my grandmother, who did some caring of me, that I wanted to be a writer at age 7. I never met a writer. I didn't know what a writer was. And we would meet people on the subway. And naturally, the old lady would ask my grandmother, you know, so after pinching my cheek and spreading powder all over me and all that kind of thing, what do you want to do when you grow up? And I would say, I want to be a writer. And my grandmother would magically interrupt and say, a doctor writer. And I think to some extent, Michelle Obama wanted Barack to be a doctor writer, that wanted him to, you know, let's get busy here. I want to have a family. I want to get rid of these loans. We can live a good life and also live pretty well. He just couldn't bear the idea of being a corporate lawyer or anything of the kind, or an investment banker. He ran away from that stuff. Remember, to graduate from Columbia in the early 80s, I graduated from Princeton in 1981, he's 82, 83, is the first crest of the Reagan years. It's the first crest of 70% of Ivy League kids in a given class interviewing at investment banks. I mean, huge numbers. Not exactly an idealistic time in these elite institutions. What does Barack Obama do? He goes and he works as a community organizer on the South Side. He's got this in him.
How different do you think, if you compare his reception by the mainstream of the country while he was running for president with hers, given...
Hers being Hillary?
I'm sorry.
Oh, with Michelle.
Hers being Michelle. And I mean, given, if I can say this right, the different tribes of African-American identity that they come from. Do you think the fact that she was a lot more
traditionally black... It's hard to say what his tribe is, do you know?
Right, yes, it is.
He's a little bit... He's not sui generis, but he's close to it.
Right, but he's different than her,
she is, right, you know.
Boom. Right, she's white within the tradition that we know about in the mainstream. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that affected how they were perceived at all throughout the campaign.
I think it did. Mm-hmm. I think there's no question about it, and it's hard to remember now. But there was a time when there was lots of talk that, you know, there's a film of Michelle and she's talking about Whitey all the time.
The Whitey tape.
And the Whitey tape. Damn. And there was also an incredible Talmudic reading of her senior thesis in college. You can imagine if that ever happened to you. Right. You want your thesis gone over? That's bad news. And she had written about race and the play, you know, what black Princeton graduates do and do they sell out, and, you know, and people got all nervous about this. I mean, because, you know, we grind it up. This is what we do in journalism, and, you know, a lot of it's for the good and some of it's ridiculous. But her image was, for some people, different. I think she played a magnificent, essential role. And by the way, to go back historically in terms of their marriage, it doesn't require me, white guy, to say this, but any number of people I spoke to, black academics and just people I talked to, various African Americans, said, look, you know, Barack Obama's not getting 94% right. of the black vote if right. he had married a white woman.
Right.
If he had married a white woman.
And you came away convinced of that?
Well, you know, sometimes in journalism you quote someone and you let it sit. I mean, it's not a demonstrable fact.
Right.
It certainly is a point of view, and it seems to me a legitimate point of view.
Right.
Who's to know?
Right.
Who's to know? We're not playing alternate histories here. This is a view taken by smart people. What do you think?
I want to think that he could have won no matter who he married. I highly doubt that he could have won.
Look at the role Michelle played in the crucial primary. Forget, Iowa is won right. without much reference to race, right? Iowa is won. Obama's differentiation from Hillary is on Iraq.
Right.
South Carolina is a different
right,
scene,
right?
So he goes.
And she had literal roots there, right? Am I correct?
She has slave roots there.
Right.
She goes to South Carolina and she comes down and gives the most amazing speech in South Carolina. She basically gets in front of a big black audience where there had been, I forget what demonstration or what scene had happened there. I'm just slipping my mind. She gets up and basically addresses a nearly all black audience, mainly women, and says, I know what you're talking about. I know, I hear it. You're afraid for him. You've lived in this country. You know what can happen. I am here to tell you, I am putting my husband out there, and so therefore should you. You have to try to imagine what it would mean for him to be president. Now, take him on his qualities, judge him on his intelligence and his policies and all the rest. I mean, don't elect him because he's one of us. But if I'm willing to take the risk, you should be. And that was a powerful message that Obama could not deliver on his own behalf. His wife did it. That was huge.
This is another quote that you have in the book. And this is the first time I had heard that angle. Obviously, there's always this great fear that something violent will happen, and that was definitely a fear during the campaign.
It's a fear now.
Valerie Jarrett, though, took a very different approach, and I think it's her that says this. She says, those people, they weren't actually scared for him. They were scared for themselves. They were scared that they were going to embarrass because he might lose.
That's true. The incident is there was a very wealthy African-American fundraiser who called Obama at the time when Obama's trying to decide whether or not to run. And he was worried, and he expressed his worry about this Obama's safety to him. And he said, you don't have to, I know you've been taking a survey, and I know what the survey is. White liberals want me to run, and the brothers, as he said, the brothers are afraid. And Valerie Jarrett, in talking to me, said, I don't think they were so much afraid for his life. I think they were afraid that our guy was going to lose and get humiliated. Look, I remember my grandfather. My grandfather hated to vote for somebody like Arthur Goldberg because, you know, you don't want to be a Shonda before the Goyim. Do you know what this means?
I have no idea what that means. I'm just going to be honest. I don't, not at all.
I think I know who's laughing now. that you don't want to fail in front of, when you're the other, although
right.
in New York, I don't know if either one of us are the other,
right,
but...
Right.
But you don't want to fail when your guy, and God willing woman, is in the position of power. It's a deeply...
Well, because then you have no excuses, right? I mean, there's no one to blame.
Hey, we elected one of
right,
them.
Right, right.
Right? So there was this little bit of that. And Obama basically figured, you know, if they're not ready now, they're not going to be ready in my lifetime. 4 years is not going to make a big difference. And he had been advised by fellow senators, you know, sticking around the Senate, you may get more experience, but you're also going to get more experience and you're going to accumulate more votes. Look at John Kerry. No one ever accuses John Kerry of a lack of experience, but we all think of him as this kind of stentorian, slightly institution-bound senator. And that was a negative for him for a lot of people, not a positive. Barack Obama was a senator overnight. He won his election. The next morning in the press conference, they're asking him about running for president. It's an amazing thing.
And how much of this, people always, you know, and there's some people who don't like him who say this in the book. Who's the gentleman that claims that they got into a fist fight or they almost got
Ricky
into a fist
Hendon.
Fight? Yes.
Ricky Hendon, who's distinguished senator, state senator from, right. from the South Side. And they got into a beef on the floor of the state senate in right. Springfield. And it came to the kind of fisticuffs or non-fisticuffs that you have in the schoolyard when it's kind of a push and kind of a you and you, you know, your mama, blah, blah, blah. And then it got broken up.
Right.
I mean, very distinguished statesmanship.
Right. And I believe it's him. It's either him or someone else that makes the point that you can't understand Barack. And I thought this was very astute, unless you understand that he's calculating, that he's looking ahead. How much of this was planned?
Which?
The whole presidency.
Well,
when do you start thinking about it? When does it?
I think everybody who gets elected to the U.S. Senate or the Congress or God knows, maybe even state houses, somewhere the tripwire happens. They look at the president, they look at somebody, and they go. I mean, come on.
Right.
Anybody who puts on a baseball glove right. thinks, Willie Mays. Right. you know. So it's possible. So. The official story is that Obama gets there and he had no thoughts whatsoever of running for president. And they instituted, headed by Pete Rouse, who's now in the White House as a deputy chief of staff, but who was his chief of staff in the Senate, they started in conjunction with Axelrod and the others something called the Strategic Plan, a total imitation of Hillary's approach to the Senate. You get to the Senate, you're a star, but you play down your stardom. You become a good colleague. You go play obeisance to Robert Byrd and all the elders of the Senate, and you're a good citizen of the Senate, and you get on committees, and you show up, and you do your work. That lasted a year. And then push came to shove. And the truth is, Obama not only was bored as a state senator, he was bored as a U.S. senator. I mean, it speaks to something of his sense of enlarged self, too. He was bored as a U.S. senator almost instantly, and somebody on his staff who knows him very well said to me that Barack would really come alive at night when he was writing his book. And that book was a campaign tool. We're talking about the second book, The Audacity of Hope. So I think, you know, if you get elected the president of the Harvard Law Review and you're the first African American, and the next morning there's a piece in the New York Times and the AP and all over the place.
You want to know how far it goes.
Your sense of your own horizon has just expanded immensely.
Right. One of the more interesting elements for me, a lot of this was made in the campaign in terms of Barack Obama's relationship with radicals and putting the campaign stuff aside. Mm-hmm. He actually had some contact repeatedly over his life, or you know, with some degree of radicals, some people who were ne'er-do-wells, etc.
He's a product of the universities. I don't know,
right.
your experience I've read about. I mean, you're bumping into radicals
right.
at the kitchen table.
Right.
But not mine, by the way.
You sure?
A radical political position in my family was if you sat too close to the television. This was considered an act of immense impiety. How can you sit there? It's too close. You come back and sit there. I kid because I love.
Right,
of course. Yes. But he went to college and at the same time as I did. What was the big political thing then? You know, South Africa.
Right.
Divestment. It got warm in the springtime. We marched around. We held signs up. We made some speeches.
Did you do this?
Okay. Yeah.
All right.
And by the way, I brought down apartheid. I don't know if you know this.
It's your next book.
Yeah. and he did this at Occidental a few times, and he was involved in political groups, but he was a little bit more involved in reading books and playing hoop and smoking a little weed and doing college guy things and getting B's and not being a particularly spectacular student.
And one of the interesting things is there are a few of these, quote-unquote, I hate that term, radicals, who you call, and they aren't particularly interested in talking about him. And throughout the campaign, they weren't particularly interested in talking because they thought anything they might do could hurt him.
But he grows up, essentially, on the South Side of Chicago. What's on the south side of Chicago? It's not like there's some big conservative movement on the south side of Chicago.
Right.
He's growing up in an environment of the University of Chicago. Okay, there are conservatives there.
Right.
But the Nation of Islam is around.
There are conservatives there, too.
Yeah, good point. Jesse Jackson's people, ditto.
Right.
But it is a left-leaning political community by any American standard.
Right, right.
You know, there was, I remember when I was doing some reporting, some people were whispering in my ear, you know, there's one of the secretaries in his office, she was a member of the Nation of Islam. Oh, my God. It's just, did he know William Ayers? Yeah, he knew William Ayers.
Right. And I bring this.
You know, Richard Posner, you know, he didn't know Posner, but he knew conservative academics at the University of Chicago, too. That didn't make him a libertarian.
Right, right.
It doesn't rub off.
I bring this up because one of the interesting things is I had, you know, my dad, who has some experience with radicalism, he called me at some point in the campaign. He was always lecturing me about how I was drinking the soda or the juice or whatever.
Kool-Aid.
You know,
Kool-Aid,
the Kool-Aid, Kool-Aid. Thank you, the Kool-Aid. Whatever it is, the Kool-Aid, thank you. And he says to me, he relays a conversation that he had had with some of his old radical friends from the 60s. And, you know, my dad's still rabble-rousing, you know, yada-da-da-da. And they said, Paul, this is the best chance we got. I don't want to hear
it.
And so I wonder,
did he go with it at the end?
Kind of. As much as he could possibly go
with
it, he did.
But this was the typical generational pushback that Obama got from the start.
I was shocked how much he actually went with it.
Look, it's like Adolf Fried. Adolf Fried's politics are different than your dad's, but he was a kind of union left-wing pushback. And Adolf Fried, in the midst of the state Senate campaign, he's now at the University of Pennsylvania, he was then at Chicago, wrote a piece basically calling Obama the product of the foundation world and an outsider. And, you know, it was a pretty brutal attack was published in the Village Voice. And he got a lot of this from the old nationalist community, of which there are a significant number on the South Side. And that was a stream of opinion that helped elect Harold Washington. Not that Harold Washington was a nationalist. By the way, we speak of nationalism as something terrible. I mean, black nationalism is part of the diversity of something we now call, in sainted terms, the civil rights movement. The civil rights movement itself was diverse.
Right.
And we forget that now because it's all focused on King.
One of the things that I took away from the book, and I was this actually, as great of a story as it is, it actually made me sad, was the feeling that I could not be president. And obviously I can't be president, but I don't mean that in the individual way. But that...
You can't be president because you have a peace due.
Right, that's right.
Okay.
That would prevent me.
I'm just saying.
Thanks for reminding me.
I'd
forgotten about that. Now I know. So this is the intimidation thing right here.
Nota bene.
but that... Any black person can't be president. It's a particular story, a particular black person who's black in a specific way. He could be president because
We'll see next time. In other words, I hope you're wrong. I hope that his election widens the gate. Maybe not even just for black people.
Right.
I think that election widened the gate immensely. And I think that Hillary Clinton was right in that she put a lot of, what's the phrase, cracks in the glass ceiling.
Right.
I mean, it's got to be more of a normalized thing. I mean, it is pathetic that this nation has never elected a woman. It's just sad. And so I think next time around, but it's going to take, you know, an individual. And that individual will have particular qualities, and we'll see how it works. But, I remember being on some panel, and I was my fellow panelist was Kwame Anthony Appiah, and we were talking about this a lot. And at the end of it, his colleague, Cornel West, said, yes, they elected Barack Obama, but they could never elect, what he meant was a much more mainstream black man, meaning somebody that would be the male equivalent or female equivalent of Michelle.
Right.
I don't know that.
Right.
I don't know how he knows it for a certainty.
That's a good point.
He may be right in 2008.
Right.
There's no doubt that Barack Obama's political education to himself was losing in a traditional African-American race on the South Side and deciding to be a different kind of politician in a different landscape, meaning the state of Illinois, which is also has Southern Illinois, which has a kind of cultural electorate that's closer to the South than it is to even the suburbs of Chicago.
Right.
And he sees, look, he is anything but foolish about this.
The other, I think, explicit reply to that is, I think 5 years ago, I don't want to speak for Cornel West, but I think people in my position felt that even a Barack Obama couldn't be elected.
I thought it was impossible. I don't know how much money I lost to Dorothy Wickenden, the executive editor of The New Yorker. But I remember we wrote two big profiles of him early on, first by Bill Finnegan during the Senate race, terrific piece, and then Larissa wrote what I think is, to me, the most right-on profile of him as a character. Ryan Lizard wrote a wonderful one of him as a Paul. Larissa got him right in a way that's it really influenced the way I looked at him in this book. And so the notion of him running came up in the office, and Dorothy Wickenden's a pretty wise woman, said, you know, I think he could win. I mean, Hillary's got a lot of baggage. It's complicated. It's wide open. There's no incumbent. And I just snottily said, you know, Barack Hussein Obama, is that, as if that ended the argument. And therefore, the wager was made, and I lost.
I'm pretty sure I'm running up against time here. I think
we can do questions from.
Yes, because I'll run right over Q&A. But I do, before I relinquish, I do want to say one thing about this book. And I was thinking so much about this. We started off with basketball. We've been talking about making basketball metaphors all the way through. I just want to say this was a beautiful, beautiful read.
Thank
I can
you.
Drop the mask.
Thank
now.
You. And can I return the compliment? I
yes.
will tell you that along with the piece I just mentioned, one of the pieces that influenced me most on how to think about him was called A Deeper Black
by
Mr. Coates. In The Nation, I'm afraid, but
that's not very nice.
Had it been in The New Yorker, I'd be a happier man. It's fine that it's in The Nation, but I really appreciate our conversations about it through time, and it's great to do this with you. So
thank
we're
you.
Not finished though, right?
No, not
okay.
at all.
All right.
I'm hoping for some controversy now. So I'll bring it on. Ta-Nehisi, you expressed to me in private, and why don't you do it now in public, that that you, not necessarily that you were disappointed with Barack Obama, but that you didn't necessarily think that the situation of African Americans would so much change with his presidency. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, sure. I don't think it's clear that it will. I mean, I hope that it will.
And you don't need to talk to me. Talk to
those. Forgive me. Sorry. I'm not clear that it necessarily. The question was how much will the situation for African Americans change? And I expressed backstage that I'm not sure that it actually will change. And if I could expound on that, even if it does, I'm not sure how much of that will be attributable to electing a black president. That the change might have just. Look, I'm a pretty left dude, so I mean that it might have been just for electing a Democrat. I think, and this is I think one of the sort of conflicts in the book. Can you claim to be, you know, the head of a Joshua generation if the generation doesn't actually advance with you? If it's only a symbol? If there is a, you know, Martin Luther King, there was real actual change. Segregation's gone. If there's no real change in terms of statistics when we talk about African Americans. I'm a suspect
but
of
here's
how,
where
how
I,
true
here's
you can
where
say
I,
that.
Here's where I disagree. You're going to know better than I do, but let's just stick with the very election of him.
Right.
Doesn't that widen horizons for kids your son's age?
I think it changes how they look. I think they will look at race different than I did, just like I look at it differently than my dad did.
Right.
It's not, but we are up against gigantic, awe-inspiring forces of history as far as I'm mm-hmm. concerned. Maybe I'm overrating it.
How can you overrate it? I don't think it's
possible. Well, I'll tell you exactly how. Mm-hmm. I didn't think he could win in a place like Iowa or Idaho. I mean, that was the most shocking thing for me. So I can overestimate precisely what we're up against. But to me, the notion, and that it's almost unfair to put this on one person to say, hey, you know, by virtue of your 8 years, you'll reverse the tide of everything.
I've got to think the 30-odd million people that just got healthcare, greater access to healthcare, that no small number of them are people of color.
I agree.
And by the way, black interests are also American interests. And if the world suddenly becomes a more dangerous place, whether it's because Iran gets nuclear weapons or because Afghanistan goes awry, and we've had just nothing but wonderful news from there in the last couple of weeks, that affects all of us. I think that's Obama's view of the presidency.
Right.
That it's a rising tide lifts all boats, and since poverty hits people of color in greater proportion than the rest of us, then economic improvement can only help black people. What he's not going to do, and what's going to frustrate Tavis or Cornell or maybe you or maybe many other people, is an over-concentration on race as such. I remember one moment, Paul, distinctly in this, kind of nervous-making interview that I had with Obama in the Oval Office. We had our talk. We talked about race a fair amount. And then he either accidentally or accidentally on purpose came out into the hallway where I was talking to somebody else, David Axelrod. And I asked him about the Henry Louis Gates Jr. situation. And, that took them off their agenda for 2 weeks, at least. And what he said was, I can make a speech about that as I did in Philadelphia. When I'm in control of the discussion and I can balance it and fill it with nuance and I can give it my full force of thinking. But when I improvise, everybody comes to it with different baggage. Everybody gets hysterical on the right, on the left, and no light is shed. And, we have this beer summit, which I don't necessarily think raised the level of anybody's discussion. Right. As much as, and, even though Obama committed the classic Washington gaffe in that press conference, the classic Washington gaffe made famous by Michael Kinsley is the inadvertent speaking of the truth. And the truth is, I would not have gotten arrested in my home and cuffed. It just wouldn't have happened. And that's what Obama was expressing, and it was a truth, and it screwed up their agenda for 2 weeks.
You were saying that your conversation with him in the Oval Office inspired you with nervousness. Can you say a little bit more about what it was like to interview him for this book, and if he was particularly suspicious?
It's a very under-decorated room. There's a bust of King, there's a bust of Lincoln, there's a couple of paintings, there's about 24 books, and an absolutely clean desk. And that's it. And a couple of, we know the scene. And you sit there, and Obama is an extremely deliberate speaker, even more so than when he's talking for the camera. He just slows it down. You can almost hear everybody's heartbeat in the room. And you hear this grandfather clock going, gung, gung, gung. It's like Edgar Allan Poe somehow in there, right? The telltale grandfather clock. And no, it wasn't, I didn't jump out of my suit. But it was interesting to see his style very close. I'd interviewed him before, but in front of an audience. This was a much smaller, and it's in the Oval Office. It's just very different. And he's very careful now. He's in office. I mean, they don't want anything to go wrong, and so his delivery is very measured. He's a pretty careful guy to begin with.
About three questions on that famous New Yorker cover.
Great. The one with the bowl of fruit?
Exactly.
That was the best! There was one of an abandoned summer house with just a clothesline going across it.
That's the other one.
I don't know what you're
talking
about.
That's the third one.
Ah. So last July, if you were out of town, you may have forgotten. It was clear who was the Democratic nominee. It was clear who the Republican nominee was. And it didn't escape notice that there were polls showing that some huge, I forget what the numbers were, some huge proportion of the population, a scary proportion, thought that Barack Obama was any number of things thought to be negative. A Muslim, a radical, as if Muslim is bad, a Muslim, a radical, that Michelle was, the second coming of Angela Davis, who the last time I looked has tenure, right? That he was soft on terrorism, blah, blah, blah. You know all the elements. And Barry Blitt, who I think is a kind of genius, put all these elements together to make them look ridiculous, to put the lie to them. And the title of the cover was called The Politics of Fear. I think it's fair to say that not everybody liked it.
Were you surprised?
I was surprised by the scale of the not everybody liking it. But I will tell you, and I totally respect whatever point of view you have by now, a lot of time has elapsed, every point of view on this. I got plenty of criticism. But most of the criticism that came in by email, phone calls, smoke signal, and all means, was the following, the printable kind. Of course I get it. I get what you're trying to say. I mean, you know, being uncomfortable with it. I of course I understand. It's those people out there who aren't going to get it, and it's going to become a kind of cudgel or worse in their hands. It's going to encourage more people to think terrible things or untrue things about Barack Obama. Well, this I found difficult to answer because I just don't think that that's how satire works. You may, again, you may hate this, I respect it, whatever it is. I got to tell you that Barack Obama doesn't hate the magazine. Barack Obama passed around Atul Gawande's piece on healthcare. Barack Obama has, through an aide, has called for other covers to be signed and sent to him. I think, you know, it was forgotten a lot faster by Barack Obama than some other people. But, that you know, it happens.
Paul, can I push back just a little bit?
I should hope so.
Okay, all right. Because, you know, I have to fess up, long before I actually knew David Remnick, I blogged quite a bit about the magazine. And I was one of the loud voices objecting to the cover. And I think even now, I would stick by this. In the context of everything that was being said right now, in the context of the campaign, it did not look ridiculous. It looked like an almost literal reflection of what some significant group of Americans actually thought would happen.
Would a cover on the New Yorker have made it worse? Is that what your fear was?
No, I didn't think it would have much impact. As satire, I just thought it didn't work. It was
fair
to me,
enough.
It would be like if Jon Stewart just ran a loop of Fox News that
but
night.
I will tell you, the next night, Jon Stewart thought it was the funniest thing since last
I remember, break. I remember.
And, you know, the cover editor and I, Francoise Mouly, and Barry talked about this a lot. It was not fun. It was not fun to go up on CNN and have
you
Wolf
were on
Blitzer.
TV, right?
I was on TV more than was absolutely necessary. And I was on TV with Wolf Blitzer. And you're sitting in the box, you know, how you're remote, and you have the thing in your ear, which you're already at a deep disadvantage. And Wolf Blitzer said, "This could have been on the cover of a Nazi magazine." And it was at this moment that I dearly hoped that my mother was not watching CNN. and, you know, context obviously meant nothing
right.
to Mr. Blitzer at that very moment.
Right.
Ta-Nehisi, in terms of disappointments with Obama so far, can you speak about some?
Yeah. I think part of the problem is I never had much expectation for politicians, so I'm sort of at a disadvantage in terms of disappointments. I think probably the biggest thing is, and this is just sort of like, and I knew I was getting this when I voted for him, but it's the sense of that the center is always right. You know, the sense of always looking for, you know, a way to triangulate. That annoyed me very much about the Clintons. I think he's a little better about that. But this oil drilling thing, for instance, just feels like, oh, let me throw away something to show that, you know, I'm bipartisan. And I think we talked about this some behind stage. I don't know that he actually gets something out of that every time. I would be much more encouraged if I thought, like, by handing healthcare over to Max Baucus and letting them, you know, discuss and sort of fiend bipartisanship for 3 months, if that had resulted in something, I think I'd be much more impressed. It almost killed it. So I think this sort of choreography of bipartisanship isn't always particularly effective. I'd be much more in favor of it if I thought it worked more.
I'd like to see the end game of each of these issues. In other words, the end game of the issue on healthcare was a victory that had taken half century. So I think credit has to be given there. And 6-7 weeks ago, we all thought it was going to blow up. On the environment, if it stays a drill, baby, drill, then I'm deeply disappointed and worse. If, in fact, that drilling is an overture to a much more aggressive environmental policy that I like as a citizen, I'm allowed to have views after all, then I'm then I'm happy.
Do you think the bipartisanship actually helped, though, us get to that healthcare victory? Or,
well, he did win. And obviously in terms of votes...
You can fumble the ball and still win, though, right? I mean...
Yeah, you can't get through a game without fumbling the ball. No. You can barely get through a game without making mistakes. And look, their policy, their way of going at it was in complete reaction to the other guy's way of going at it. The Clintons went at it by doing it all in the White House and getting everybody in there and shutting out Congress and, you know, this is obviously a cartoon, but trying to shove it down the throat that way. They lost, and it diminished not just that issue, but it diminished the entire presidency for years to come. Obama does this other thing. He's got Rahm Emanuel in there, and by the way, his aides around him don't want this to happen at all. They want him to focus completely on the economy as such. He does it on his volition, and he does it the opposite way. He gives Max Baucus and all these congressional guys ownership of it. Does it work? No, not in the short term at all. Does he win? Yeah. And I'm not so sure that the Republican self-confidence that somehow by winning this victory they will lose devastating losses in November will come true. We'll see. We'll see.
There's a disappointments in his dealings or lack of dealings in issues pertaining to torture?
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree with Jane Mayer and Cy Hirsch and other people who have written this. I'm very concerned, for example, about the rollback on that, the getting rid of Greg Craig, the business of continuing any number of aspects of the harsher aspects of the Bush administration's so-called war on terror, wiretapping, unauthorized wiretapping, and the rest. I think the things that Dick Cheney has said about this are astonishing, and really bewildering to hear from a high-ranking American official. And maybe I'm being completely naive about Dick Cheney, but at this point I shouldn't be.
In closing, could you talk a little bit about what it was to write, like to write this book? Because as I recall, when we spoke about it months ago, you were to finish it in a few months from now. And you finished this book very quickly. And I'm wondering how it was for you to write this book and if it was a passionate journey.
Well, I have a day job. That's not just a day job. It's a job that extends into all... It's not just doing it. It's also thinking about it all the time. And so to have it shared time and mental energy with a project like this, I knew I couldn't let the book keep going and going. I mean, maybe if I'd worked 2 years or 3 years on it, it'd be shorter, as they say about fiction. But I gave myself a very definite period of time, 1 month, 2 month difference, it's immaterial. And I couldn't do that every year, and I would never do it. I waited 12 years to write a book after becoming editor of The New Yorker. The last book I wrote was about Muhammad Ali, and it was finished before I started this job. We're right now in a very important moment in publishing in general, in newspapers and magazines and all the rest. And I have to concentrate really with all my being on essential questions, not only of the issue that week and next month and down the line, but our very being and our survival and thriving and our economic well-being and how we're going to be read on, if you want to read us on an iPad or wherever you want to read us. Those are important things. And my guiding principle for this is that if we are, first of all, we are going to thrive because I think there's a very big audience in the United States who wants to read what it is we do, that people don't want less depth, they want more depth, our readers. They don't want journalism that cowers in a corner, they want stuff that has boldness. And I don't think there are more and more places like this. There are fewer potentially because of the challenges we are going through. I mean, for all the things you can argue with about The New Yorker or The Times or a few other places, the only way for them to thrive, the only way for them to be, and the only way I'm interested in having anything to do with it, is to do what we've done and more so, not less so. And if that involves designing a beautiful way to read it on the iPad, so be it. That's wonderful. If that's going to the delivery system that works for either everybody or half of everybody or a quarter of everybody, whatever. That's great. Fine. Or the internet or all the rest of it. I need to concentrate on that. So I gave myself a year. It took a year. I'm sleeping a little bit more on Saturdays and Sundays, and I'm, you know, this is not a stunt that I'm going to try very often.
In closing, what was the biggest surprise in writing this book?
That I got it done.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Great.